Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. New guidelines from the UN Health Agency released on Monday have advised against using non-sugar sweeteners. The recommendation from the World Health Organization, or WHO, is based on a review of available evidence which suggests that artificial sweeteners do not help control body mass or reduce the risk of weight-related illnesses. WHO also noted the potential undesirable effects from long-term use of non-sugar sweeteners, such as an increased risk of type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. Francesco Branca, WHO Director for Nutrition and Food Safety, said that non-sugar sweeteners had no nutritional value and that people should consider alternatives to artificial sweeteners to lower their sugar intake. Healthier options that are crucial to improved well-being include eating food with naturally occurring sugars, such as fruit, or getting used to a diet of unsweetened food and beverages early on in life, the UN official said. Treating homosexuality as a crime costs lives and endangers health, UN experts on fighting HIV/AIDS said on Monday, as they urged all countries to decriminalise same-sex relations. The call from UNAIDS comes ahead of Wednesday's International Day Against Homophobia, Transphobia and Biphobia. Legalising men having sex with men and women having sex with women will save lives and is a crucial step towards equality, dignity and health for all, said Christine Stegling, a UNAIDS Deputy Executive Director. According to the UN agency, 67 countries still ban same-sex relations by law and 10 impose the death penalty. 20 nations criminalise gender diversity. UNAIDS maintained that this criminalisation of the gay community prevents LGBTQI plus people from accessing life-saving services. It can also lead to health service providers being harassed by vigilantes or police for assisting them, said UNAIDS. In countries where same-sex relations are criminalised, HIV prevalence is 5 times higher among gay men and men who have sex with men than in countries where homosexuality is not a crime. UN member states meeting in Geneva have agreed to eliminate the use of 3 toxic chemicals used widely in farming and industry around the world. UNEP, the UN Environment Programme, said that the pesticide methoxychlor and the industrial chemicals Declarane Plus and UV328 are to be phased out after being added to the annexes of the Stockholm Convention. This key international environmental treaty oversees global action against persistent organic pollutants that are described as chemical substances that persist in the environment, accumulate in the food chain, and pose a risk to human health and our surroundings. The bug killer methoxychlor has been used instead of dichlorodiphenyl trichloroethane, or DTT, against a wide range of pests, including biting flies, mosquito larvae, and cockroaches. DDT has been detected in the Arctic and Antarctica, and UNEP described it as very highly toxic to invertebrates and fish. The other soon-to-be-banned chemicals are dechlorane, a flame retardant, and UV328, an ultraviolet light absorbent. Both of these chemicals are heavily used as plastic additives in motor vehicles, industrial machines, and medical devices. According to the World Health Organization, in 2019, a small number of chemicals for which data are available were estimated to have caused 2 million deaths, including from heart and respiratory diseases, as well as cancers. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas, your one true voice in Kansas, the Missouri Radio Free Kansas.
Boy, I'm telling you, do you believe poor Mr. Johnson, Daniel Johnson, who read the UN news brief you heard just now. Having to read all those chemical names. Oh, thank you very much, Daniel, at the United Nations for trying and doing a great job, better than I could do. Well, today is we're back on Tuesday. We're going to have John Grant Lies in the second hour today. I'm pretty excited about that. And the weather, let's see, here in northeast Kansas, it's 67 degrees Fahrenheit, mostly cloudy, and it's been off and on showers in the last 24 hours. So, and it started out this morning, rather chilly, seeming to be chilly, 50 degrees, rather than less. It was rather cold, chilly, and wet. That's been the last, 36 hours, maybe. Coming up, we've got the latest Democracy Now! Headlines and counter spin from the Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, F-A-I-R, fair.org, hosted by Janine Jackson. And it's the usual lineup, folks. Intense news, deep news to follow in the second hour. I hope you've had a good work day so far. If not, consider taking it off. We'll have a musical interlude after the Democracy Now! And Counterspin shorts, and I'll get back with you then. Hold on here. Let me ring up this. Here we go with the latest headlines from this morning's Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Sudan, military forces unleashed airstrikes near a hospital in the capital, Khartoum, on Monday, targeting paramilitary rivals as fighting between the warring parties enters a second month. Airstrikes and shelling were reported in other cities in recent days, including intense battles in the western region of Darfur and in the cities of Bahri and Omdurman. The UN estimates some 200,000 people have fled Sudan to neighboring countries since the war erupted in April, the vast majority of those displaced being women, children, many of whom are malnourished. Hundreds of people who've escaped the violence in the capital to relatively safe cities like Port Sudan now face shortages of food, water, and shelter as extreme heat hits the region.
People, they don't like us to be here. And now the way we are here with the children and the mothers, some of them are sick, and some of them, there's no food people they can eat. So we are suffering.
Over 600 people have reportedly died since the beginning of the conflict, though the death toll is expected to be much higher. The prominent Sudanese singer, Shaden Gardoud, was killed in crossfire between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces in Omdurman City Friday, despite an agreement between the two sides to protect civilians. Meanwhile, there's been multiple reports of women and girls being sexually assaulted by armed groups. In Somalia, the United Nations says some 450,000 people in the central Hiran region have been displaced by flash flooding caused by torrential rains. At least 22 people have died. This comes after a record drought in Somalia left millions of Somalis on the brink of famine. China's government has issued heat advisories in the capital, Beijing, and other major cities as temperatures reach record highs for the date. In North America, an early season heat wave has smashed high temperature records along the west coast of Canada and the United States, with Seattle and Portland reporting record highs for several days in a row. On Monday, the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau visited Alberta province, where an intense early start to the wildfire season has forced tens of thousands of people to evacuate and slashed oil production in Canada's tar sands region. In the United States, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned Monday the U.S. remains on track to default on its debts as soon as June 1st unless congressional leaders agree to a deal raising the limit on the national debt. Her warning came as House Republican leaders rejected White House proposals to close tax loopholes as part of any deal to raise the debt ceiling. The proposal sought to collect more tax revenue from cryptocurrency transactions and from large real estate investors. President Biden said Sunday he's optimistic lawmakers will reach a deal by June 1st, an idea shot down Monday by Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy.
So no, I don't think we're in a good place. I know we're not. This ignoring the problem, thinking it's going to go away, he could bumble his way just into a default like he did on the border.
The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case that could see South Carolina reinstate a congressional redistricting plan that was struck down by a lower court as an attempt at racist gerrymandering. In January, a three-judge panel of the Federal District Court in Columbia, South Carolina, ruled unanimously state Republicans unfairly drew maps that split black neighborhoods in Charleston, leading to the exile of more than 30,000 African-American citizens from their previous districts. In Washington, D.C., Special Counsel John Durham has completed his investigation into the FBI's probe of Russian interference in the 2016 Trump campaign. Durham's 300-plus page report concluded the FBI should never have launched its investigation, which Durham said was based largely on leads provided by political opponents of Donald Trump and relied heavily on, quote, raw, unanalyzed, and uncorroborated intelligence, unquote. The report does not recommend any major changes to FBI and Justice Department policies. Durham was appointed special counsel in 2019 by then Attorney General Bill Barr after Barr referred to the FBI's court-authorized activities as spying. In New York, a $10 million lawsuit filed Monday against former New York City Mayor and Donald Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani alleges Giuliani raped and harassed a former associate over the span of 2 years. The suit was filed by Noelle Dunphy, who says Giuliani hired her in 2019, promising an annual salary of $1 million, but instead repeatedly sexually assaulted her. She also accuses Giuliani of being constantly drunk, making racist and sexist remarks and anti-Semitic comments, many of which were recorded. Giuliani also allegedly plotted to sell pardons for $2 million, the lawsuit alleges, to be split between him and former President Donald Trump, who was giving the pardons, and asked Dunphy to refer anyone who needed one. In New Mexico, three people were killed and six others injured in the community of Farmington Monday morning when an 18-year-old armed with an AR-15-style assault rifle and two other guns went on a rampage, firing randomly as he walked through a neighborhood before he was shot dead by police. Investigators say they're still searching for a motive and haven't released the names of the dead and wounded. New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham said in a statement, quote, "This serves as yet another reminder of how gun violence destroys lives in our state and our country every single day," she said. According to the Gun Violence Archive, it was the 225th mass shooting in the United States so far this year. Vice Media has filed for bankruptcy less than a month after laying off over 100 workers across its global newsroom. A group of company lenders, including Soros Fund Management, has submitted a bid of $225 million to purchase Vice's assets, while remaining operations are expected to keep running. The media company was once considered to be worth $5.7 billion. In April, Vice canceled its award-winning weekly show, Vice News Tonight, and shut down its international news unit, Vice World News. And a warning to our audience, our last headline contains graphic footage of violence. San Francisco's district attorney said Monday she will not bring charges against a security guard who shot and killed 24-year-old black trans activist Banco Brown last month after he allegedly tried to steal snacks from a Walgreens pharmacy. The announcement came as the DA's office released surveillance video of the killing. It shows the guard repeatedly punching Brown, slamming him to the floor, and lying on top of him. After Brown flees the store, the guard pulls out a handgun and fires a single fatal shot directly into Brown's chest. District Attorney Brooke Jenkins on Monday called the killing reasonable.
What he said was, "I saw a movement that led me to believe something dangerous was about to happen to me. Could have been a knife, could have been whatever it was, I believed that I was in imminent danger." And the law doesn't require that you wait and see. Is it a gun? Is it a knife? Is it scissors? The law allows you to have a perception and a belief so long as it's reasonable.
Brooke Jenkins was appointed San Francisco's interim district attorney last July by Mayor London Breed, replacing former progressive DA Chesa Boudin, who was ousted by voters in a multi-million dollar funded special recall election led by the real estate industry. Jenkins received over $100,000 as a consultant for a nonprofit that led efforts to recall Boudin. Banco Brown's killing has ignited protests across the San Francisco Bay Area, where nearly half of all residents live in families listed as low income or very low income. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, USA Today reported that, quote, as it heads into the final stretch of its current term, the Supreme Court is on defense following a series of revelations about gifts, property sales, and disclosure, close quote. That, you might say, is putting it mildly. The recent revelations are not about trinkets, but millions of dollars worth of benefits, vacations, jobs, and not from nowhere in particular, but from powerful parties with express interest in shaping the court's decision-making. Disclosure, in this instance, is another word for democracy. People's right to know and act upon the knowledge of what, besides their votes, is influencing the laws that shape their lives. As details of Clarence Thomas's secret, but not so secret, relationship with Republican billionaire Harlan Crow, and also with Federalist Society head Leonard Leo, roll out, the John Roberts-led Supreme Court has told congressional leaders they don't believe any ethics rules apply to them. And that's not a problem. Whether that cravenly elitist, anti-democratic notion gets to carry the day will depend on many things, one of them being journalists' willingness to stick with the stories, explore their structural and historical roots, demand transparency, and keep reporting faithfully to the public about what is learned and what is not and why not, even or especially if the court is on defense. Because the information out of the Supreme Court has, as Slate's Dahlia Lithwick has said, gone beyond an ethics problem to a five-alarm fire democracy reform problem, and news media will be central to the response. So even as our minds are reeling with the malfeasance, fiasco, horror show, choose your descriptor, of CNN offering sexual predator and liar Donald Trump a national platform to lie and defame the day after he was found guilty of lying and defaming, complete with a crowd cheering him on, we're going to talk this week about the Supreme Court, where it's going and where it's taking all of us. We'll talk with Ian Millhiser, who covers the court for Vox and is author of, most recently, The Agenda, How a Republican Supreme Court is Reshaping America. That's coming up this week on Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. If you are disturbed but also overwhelmed by the sheer volume and severity of revelations of corruption at the U.S. Supreme Court, you're far from alone. Clarence Thomas, his wife Ginny, and billionaire operative Harlan Crow may be at the current epicenter, but our guest suggests the problem, and consequently the necessary response, is much bigger and deeper. Ian Millhiser covers the court and the Constitution as senior correspondent at Vox. He's the author of the book Injustices, The Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted, and The Agenda, How a Republican Supreme Court is Reshaping America. He joins us now by phone from Virginia. Welcome to Counterspin, Ian Millhiser.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much.
Well, let's start with the information that many folks will have heard at least some piece of. Clarence Thomas has been recipient of millions of dollars worth of gifts, including vacations, homes, the private school tuition of a child he says he's raising as a son, from Republican billionaire Harlan Crow, without disclosure. As you've noted, this relationship between Thomas and Crow has actually been going on for years and has been known about for years. Thomas's line has been, there's no conflict because Harlan Crow doesn't have any business before the court. That's not true, and if it were, I imagine that many people would be surprised to learn that the standard of the highest court in the land is that a powerful billionaire who overtly wants to reshape the country's laws and regulations can give you lots of money and benefits over decades, and it doesn't matter if they aren't a named party in a case you're actively considering. But we aren't missing something, and Roberts and all the justices, I understand, signed a letter saying basically we aren't really governed by ethics rules, but it's okay because we follow them anyway. Are we missing something, or is this really the court's official response to this?
Yeah, I mean, the court's position is essentially no one can tell them what to do. I mean, you know, they use the word separation of powers a lot to claim that it would be wrong if Congress or someone else imposed an ethics code on them. But the reality that it creates is that there are no rules for the justices other than the rules that they feel like complying with. And to be clear, if the justices worked anywhere else in government, there would be extraordinary ethics constraints on them. You know, there's a statute that says if you work for a federal agency, you cannot accept any gifts, period, from anyone who is regulated by the agency that you work for. If you're a member of Congress, or even if you're just a congressional staffer, there's a rule saying that if you want to accept a gift, even from one of your lifelong friends, and it's more than $250, you have to get approval from the House Ethics Committee. I used to work for an organization, we'd host a lot of congressional staffers for lunches sometimes, and they would ask us before we served them the meal, did this cost more than $25? The reason why is because under the ethics rules, if the meal costs more than $25, they aren't allowed to eat it. And so those are the rules that apply to other people in government. The rules that apply to the Supreme Court justices, apparently, are that Clarence Thomas can accept a $500,000 vacation from a billionaire, and there's nothing wrong with that, or at least nothing can be done to him.
John Roberts wrote an opinion some years ago vacating the conviction of former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, who had been convicted of accepting luxury gifts and loans from a bigwig. And in Roberts' opinion, he said it was distasteful, but our concern is not with tawdry tales of Ferraris, Rolexes, and ball gowns. That seems to say we're just above all of this. You know, you might think this is a concern, but we're Supreme Court justices, and we're just above it all.
This, I guess, shows you why they've taken such a blasé attitude to all these gifts that Clarence Thomas is getting. I mean, they almost don't believe that the concept of corruption exists.
That's what I was wondering, you know.
Yeah. Basically what they have said, I mean, they said this explicitly, I mean, this was the holding of the Citizens United decision, is that the only thing that counts as corruption is an explicit quid pro quo arrangement. So, like, if I go to a congressman and I say, I will give you $10,000 if you vote for this bill, that's the one thing that the Supreme Court has said actually qualifies as corrupt. But if I am, say, a lobbyist for, you know, let's say the pork industry, and I write a congressman a $10,000 check and say, here's $10,000, I'd like to have a meeting with you. And then in that meeting, I say, here's a list of bills I want you to vote for. The Supreme Court has said that's not corruption because there was no explicit, you only get the $10,000 if you do what I said. You know, they even said in the Citizens United case that it is good that elected officials are more responsive to their donors because, quote, democracy is premised on responsiveness. So you're dealing with a bunch of folks who don't see any problem at all with people who have a lot of money and who are willing to spend it on public officials getting more access and getting more beneficial outcomes from government. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that, you know, Clarence Thomas, who has joined all those decisions, say, well, you know, if members, you know, if Bob McDonald can get a Rolex and if members of Congress can get these $10,000 donations, why can't I get, you know, all the goodies that I want?
Right, right. It's just the joke is on everybody else, right? You know,
right.
I want to ask you about a big thing that I think folks may not have learned about yet. I want to ask you about Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council. Can you just tell us about the significance of that 1984 ruling and then the significance of its potential overturn, which is possibly going to happen?
So one trend I've been watching very closely in this court, and I mean this I think should trouble everyone who's worried about the corruption in the court as well, is that this court is very eager to concentrate power within itself. And this is a break. I mean, there's all kinds of cases throughout the 20th century establishing that courts should be reluctant to exercise power, you know, in part because federal judges aren't elected. So when they exercise power, they are taking power away from democratically elected officials. Chevron is one of those cases. Chevron essentially said that when a federal agency issues a regulation, the way that a lot of federal law works is that Congress writes a law and it delegates to a federal agency the power to figure out how to implement that law, how to achieve the goals of the law. The agency issues a regulation using the authority that's been delegated to it by Congress. And Chevron said that generally courts should defer to the agencies when they issue those decisions. Courts should stay out of the question of whether those regulations are good ideas or not. And the reason why is twofold. You know, one is that judges don't know a lot about the subject matters that agencies regulate. Agencies know more and are likely to do it well. And then the other reason why is that while the heads of federal agencies typically are not elected, they are all appointed by and serve at the pleasure of an elected president. And so there's still democratic accountability there in a way that there isn't in the judiciary. Chevron has been around since 1984. The Supreme Court recently announced that it will take a case that seeks to overrule Chevron. And I see this quest to overrule Chevron as part of this much bigger project the current court is engaged in, of trying to concentrate power in the Supreme Court itself and to roll back all these old decisions that have said that judges should be reluctant to exercise power.
And just as a point of information, or maybe more, Clarence Thomas wrote the majority opinion on Chevron, right? But now he's opposed? He says he's matured and changed his mind?
Chevron was handed down before Thomas's
okay.
time.
Okay.
It was Justice Stevens who wrote the opinion. I believe that Thomas was in the Reagan administration when Chevron was handed down.
That's right.
But we have seen a huge shift. Thomas used to join decisions advocating for judicial restraint, like what was argued in Chevron. Justice Scalia, the conservative icon, was an evangelist for Chevron. And of course, Scalia was an evangelist for Chevron in the 1980s when Republicans controlled the government. And so conservatives were very, very happy for courts to stay out of policymaking and leave matters up to the experts in the federal agencies when those agencies were controlled by the Republican Party. When we started to see conservatives, including people like Thomas, away from this support for judicial restraint was when Barack Obama moved into the White House. And all of a sudden, there was a risk that Democrats might be making calls within the agencies. And so all of a sudden, you know, many of the same conservative judges who had been huge advocates of judicial restraint under Ronald Reagan suddenly decided that the court should be more active in checking Barack Obama.
Well, for some people, when the guy who starred in Bedtime for Bonzo became president, it damaged the role, the legitimacy of the presidency itself. The court packing by a president who didn't even win the majority vote, the guy who likes beer, you know, the Roe overturning, Citizens United, it's led to a similar sort of drop in many people's respect for the Supreme Court. Confidence in the court, we hear, is at historic low, to which you have said, good. And not just that, but that if one knows the Supreme Court's history and understands its structure, what's going on today is not this wild, unprecedented, how could this happen situation that some might suggest. What should we understand?
The thing to understand about the Supreme Court throughout history is, like, first of all, you don't get on the Supreme Court unless you're a lawyer, and you don't get on it unless you're a fairly elite lawyer. So it's an institution that has always been controlled by elite professionals. And I mean, I'm a lawyer myself. I don't think that all lawyers are terrible human beings. But when you have a graduate degree and you earn the kind of money that lawyers can make, that tends to skew your perspective on society. So it doesn't surprise me that this institution that will always be controlled by elites has not been a particularly beneficent organization in American history. You know, the history of judicial review, the idea that the Supreme Court is allowed to strike down federal law, the first case they ever did was Marbury v. Madison. All that Marbury said is that they're allowed to do it. The second case they ever did that in was Dred Scott, which was an abysmal pro-slavery decision, which said that black people, and I apologize, this is offensive language, but is what the opinion said, that black people are, quote, beings of an inferior order and therefore aren't entitled to the same rights as white people. So that was the second time the court ever exercised judicial review. We passed three constitutional amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, to get rid of Dred Scott. And the court spent the first 30 or 40 years those amendments were in effect basically writing them out of the Constitution. And then they spent the next 30 or 40 years in what is known as the Lochner era, where they read the amendment that was supposed to achieve racial equality in the United States to protect business owners from laws that gave their workers a minimum wage, from laws that allowed their workers to unionize, from laws that said that workers could not be overworked. That's the history of the Supreme Court. You know, I could go on. I could talk about Korematsu. I could talk more about Citizens United. I could talk about them striking down parts of the Voting Rights Act. But the Supreme Court, for almost all of American history, has been a malign force. And, you know, that's a big reason why I often argue that it should have much less power.
Well, and let me just draw you out on one thing, because the media sort of depiction is Republicans and Democrats fight over these tools, you know, of which the right. court is one, and whoever gets them or gets control of them has power. But that's not quite how it goes. There are reasons that it's harder to do progressive policy with control of the court than the other way around, yeah?
Two responses. I mean, one is just with respect to the assertion that, well, this is just a prize that, like, both parties fight over, and whoever gets it fair and square. We are supposed to be a democracy. We have presidential elections every 4 years in this country. That means that if your candidate wins the presidential election, your party should get to govern for 4 years. It does not mean that you should get to govern for 40 years. One impact of the fact that Donald Trump happened to get elected at a time when three seats became vacant on the court is it means that this guy who lost the popular vote, who tried to overthrow the federal government, got to appoint a third of the Supreme Court. And there's just a recent paper that came out by a friend of mine up at Harvard, which argues that Democrats may not have a shot of regaining a majority on the Supreme Court until 2060. You know, I will probably be dead the next time there's a Democratic majority on the Supreme Court. So again, I think it is fair that if Republicans run a candidate for president and that candidate wins the election fair and square, then they get 4 years of power. They should not 40 years of power. And on top of that, the power that they get, courts are very good at striking down laws. They're very good at saying no to things. Courts can't really build anything from scratch. Courts don't have economists. They don't have people who enforce their decisions. They don't have the web of bureaucracy that you need to create, say, a welfare state. And so courts wind up being much more powerful tools in the hands of conservatives. People want to stop the government from doing things because the court can always strike a law down. They can always say no to a policy that is enacted. But they just aren't very good at building things. You know, again, they do not have the staff. They do not have the infrastructure to build policies. They can only destroy.
Maybe following from that, you have written there are better ways to design a judiciary. Can you tell us just a little bit about what you think some of those ways might be?
The idea behind a court is that you're supposed to have judges who are obedient to legal texts. They read the statute. They read the Constitution. They read what the precedents say. The answer to every legal question isn't always 100% clear, but judges are supposed to do their best job of following what the law is, regardless of what they want the policy to be. That kind of system is, you know, it's really hard to have disinterested public servants in those roles as judges if the way that you pick those judges is that a partisan president nominates people that inevitably that partisan president will think will implement their agenda from the bench. And then those judges are confirmed by a partisan Senate. The way that we choose judges all but guarantees the sort of people who serve as judges will be partisans. They will not engage in that disinterested practice of reading the legal text and trying in good faith to discern what the law is, not what they want the policy to be. Other countries, other, you know, states in the United States do it very differently.
Mm-hmm.
There is the Missouri model, which is where you have a commission and you have, you know, different inputs into the commission. The governor gets to appoint a few members. The bar gets to appoint a few members. I believe in Missouri, the chief justice gets to appoint a member. The idea is you have enough inputs onto this commission, so it is much harder for one party to capture control over judicial selection. And then different states do it in different ways, different countries' selection systems, they do it in different ways. The way that it works specifically in Missouri is that when there's a state Supreme Court vacancy, the commission comes up with three names. The governor has to pick one of them. And that helps reduce the partisanship of the judiciary. The French system, some of France's courts are staffed by civil servants. Like, literally someone goes to judge school. They get a graduate degree that qualifies them to be a judge, and then they move up the ranks and are promoted from within. There are many ways to design a judicial selection process in a way that doesn't make judges into partisan appointees, and unfortunately, we just don't do that at the federal level in the United States.
Okay, well, your work at Vox, ProPublica, Politico, The Lever, Washington Post, all of the stories and exposés around this court corruption story, it's showing really the power and the importance of investigative reporting. Crow's laughable line about how he covered up payments to Ginni Thomas in one case because people are so mean, and if it got out, people would say mean things about her, you know. It's laughable, but it's not
right.
Funny. And I just have to think that surely what some powerful people are taking away from this is that there should be no more exposés, you know? I wonder if, along with what legislators might do or what people might do, what would you hope to see journalists do to keep this from being a kind of couple weeks long scandal and then we're on to something else?
It is a good question because I think if Clarence Thomas, again, if you were in any other branch of government, like if we found out that the Secretary of, I don't know, let's say Secretary of Transportation was getting flown all over the world, taking these lavish vacations, being paid for by billionaire political donor, like the Secretary of Transportation would lose their job because it would be too much of a scandal and it would blow back on the president if they weren't fired. If a member of Congress did this, they would probably resign. And if they didn't resign, they would be pushed out of office either in their primary election because their own party wouldn't want them as an anchor hanging around their neck or in the next general election. In the Supreme Court, the only way to remove a justice is by impeachment. That takes 67 votes in the U.S. Senate, which means that you would need at least 16 Republicans to vote to remove that justice. And I mean, Clarence Thomas could eat a live human baby on national television, and there wouldn't be 16 Republican votes to remove him from office. You know, they are committed to keeping this man on the Supreme Court. I've covered the Supreme Court for a very long time. I covered Clarence Thomas's scandals in which he accepted gifts from billionaire Harlan Crow in 2011, a dozen years ago, I was on this story. It flared up. I wrote about it. A bunch of other reporters wrote about it. I went on the Rachel Maddow show twice to discuss it, and nothing happened because under our Constitution, Clarence Thomas is impossible to fire. And so we can keep shining a light on this. I think the most important thing that journalists can do is make it clear that Clarence Thomas is a Republican and to speak of the court, speak of the justices as political appointees chosen by partisan officials so that the voters know, okay, if I don't want someone like Clarence Thomas appointed in the future, I know which party to blame. But ultimately, that's the only leverage that voters have with respect to the Supreme Court, because they enjoy these extraordinary protections from being fired virtually no matter what they do.
And that just underscores the importance of voting rights, right? It all kind of tangles together when the tools that you need to fight back against something like this are at least partly in the hands of the very people that you would be fighting.
Now it's getting so much attention because Dobbs happened, because of the scandals with Thomas, because of the circumstances that led to Brett Kavanaugh getting on the court. People are beginning to realize there are interesting stories, important stories to be told there. But ultimately, like I said, any consequences for what the court has done is going to be one step removed from the people who are actually doing the terrible thing. We probably cannot remove Thomas or Kavanaugh or any of those folks. The thing that voters need to understand is just that these are Republican political appointees doing these things. And if you think that the things that they are doing are bad, then, you know, take that into account when you show up at the voting booth.
All right, we'll end it there for now. We've been speaking with Ian Millhiser, senior correspondent at Vox, author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted, and The Agenda, How a Republican Supreme Court is Reshaping America. Ian Millhiser, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
All right, thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The website is also the place to show support for the show if you are able and so inclined. Counterspin is engineered by Riley Baer and Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
available in the public domain at the Internet Archive for as long as it lasts. Lots of controversy around the Internet Archive nowadays. Countervailing lawsuits over reprinting and scanning books. I don't think they have a problem with the music. Maybe this is now banned. It's getting ridiculous that you cannot recommend and play music, old music like this, that most people have no idea exists. Henry Mancini, a series of crime jazz. He's written a lot of crime jazz. And I use the stuff as, I guess, available for the public to consume. Coming up at the top of the hour is John Grant, back after a hiatus. He was on assignment last Tuesday, not for me, but he was on assignment nevertheless, taking photographs, as his calling has been, and sorely missed here on our Tuesday shows. He has a book today he wants to talk about. It's a peculiar book. I haven't heard of the author or the title before, and it should be interesting. Of course, we have the New York Times available to us to visit about, and of course, culture. Whatever's on non-cable, cable, Netflix. I try to get John to discuss what normal people can watch, you know. Normal people meaning people who can't afford cable and can barely afford Netflix or Amazon Prime. Here comes one up I very seldom play because distributed on television, so I'm always reluctant to do that. But here's another. All these are Mancini, Henry Mancini. By the studios that made the original Peter Gunn. That's the theme song from Peter Gunn for you out there, young people who don't know your crime jazz. the first one, what was that first one? Let me look here. I think the first one I played earlier was The Floater. Yeah. Now, I don't think that was ever part of a movie that I know of. And then here's another obscure Henry Mancini, Quiet Gas. That's the name of it. I'll be back. There you go. I've been looking at the titles. I don't see any of these other than the theme from Peter Gunn. Obviously, probably some sort of copyright protection there in conjunction with the studios. However, these may be in some sort of public domain. Quiet Gas, Sort of Blue, The Floater. These are obscure, very obscure classics, crime jazz from Henry Mancini. We got one more here, Sorta. Let's see. That was Quiet Gas. We're going to play Sorta Blue, and we'll see if we can get John Grant on.
Thank you.
John Grant on the phone here, coming up here in a little bit. Boy, I'll tell you, sorry about that extended stay there. I had a little trouble getting John Grant on the phone, but we got John Grant after a missed week. We missed him last week, didn't we, listeners? John, are you there?
Hey, I'm here. Michael.
Mike. That's good. I'm glad. All right. Yeah, I'm glad. It's good to have you
we
back.
We got the hookup, the tech hookup here. Good.
Yeah, I had a little problem there. Well, it's weather. Let's talk weather for 2 minutes. 67 degrees, high of 70 degrees here. And it's been wet and chilly for the last 2 days, and this is the warmest it's been in 2 days. So what's it like in your place?
Well, yesterday was a little cool, but today is in the 80s. It's sunny. It's beautiful today. So I guess we'll be waiting for that cold front coming from you guys or whatever, you know. Usually you get it first. The weather systems come. And often the bad weather just sort of swoops north of us and misses us in southeast Pennsylvania.
Yeah,
we'll
you would think of the way you carry on about your weather, you'd think it was like Florida or California. It's just always wonderful. What was the name of that TV show? I remember The Sunny Side of the Street. Wasn't that supposed to be in Philadelphia or something? I'm trying to remember the name of that.
Well, yeah, I forget the title of it. It had that little short actor. What's his name?
DeVito.
It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia was the name of it.
Yeah, yeah, that's the name of it. Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of a wacky show.
Yeah. It's a wacky show, and I you can't watch it hardly. You can't get it anywhere out here. But so... You never think about that in terms of Pennsylvania or Philadelphia being this kind of weather. You know, I mean, it's sort of like, you know.
Well, you know, my wife and I always comment that we are really lucky here. There is no bad weather issues that we really have. Sometimes there's a little flooding, but nothing, you know, serious. Unless it's, of course, your house that floods, your cellar or whatever, but no major things. And we're on the high point, and the water all drains down to all our neighbors at the bottom of the hill. So, okay.
We have people on local Kansas Public Radio. We have all this during this time of year, we have over and over people, you know, weather warnings, people warning people to have their severe weather radios ready.
Yeah.
Encouraging people to enroll in tornado watch spotters.
Yeah.
Be a spotter.
You're in Tornado Alley, notorious.
Not really. But I don't think it's as bad as it used to be. I mean,
spread around because we've had, you know, tornadoes here, a couple small ones, and of course, my dear wife is panicked about them. You know, she sees one coming all the time. You know, it's like when we went to California that one time, she knew that the Andreas Fault was going to go off when we were there. She really did. Was worried about it. I said, Jesus Christ, Lynn, stop worrying.
Well, current events, we'll go to this. I told the listeners earlier, before the musical break we took, that you have a new book to discuss. But let's not discuss it right now. I want to discuss, get your viewpoints of what's in the New York Times about the debt limit talks. Because if the debt limit talks fail, there is no question we're in a world of shit economically.
A world of shit is definitely, and, you know, it's here. Where is it on the front page? Probably somewhere. I read it. Where was it? There's a story in here, but it's on the op-ed page. There's a story that suggests that,
Did you hear McCarthy today? McCarthy's out today.
What did he say today?
There's no movement. No movement. Biden is not moving.
Right. Well, Biden apparently has some emergency options. I can't find the story and all this stuff. But apparently he does have some options that there are rules, you know, that they can find. And of course, in the sort of world, corrupt world we live in now, where the criminal justice and the justice system and the Supreme Court system down is under great cloud of question, you know, with the Supreme Court justices being a bunch of bribe-taking crooks and stuff, if you believe those stories, that, you know, people are pushing the legal envelope. It's like, what's legal? We're starting, everybody, liberals and everybody, starting to wait. If this system is so, you know, problematic, well, let's start doing what the Republicans do. You know, fuck the law. Let's just push the edges where we can in order to prevent this default. And then, of course, it would have to go, the power would be in the presidency to do something, and it would have to go to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court would then decide whether to, you know, turn the country into a, you know, economic bomb, and you know, the dollar would go down and all that. So it's then up to these Supreme Court justices. You know, and in that frame, there's a really, really interesting story in the Times today. My wife and I both read it and came up with, like, what a wacky story it was. And it's on that idea of how the laws are worked in America, you know. And it's a 1871 law that applies to... you know, the idea of what is immunity, qualified immunity, the laws of qualified immunity, which is what, you know, covers the ass of police when they shoot black people and things like that. Well, you cops have qualified immunity because, you know, they're protecting the peace, and, you know, so we have to give them a little yardage there and let them go. Well, this qualified immunity law, which is called Section 1983, I guess, of the, you know, federal law system, called Section 1983 on qualified immunity, was written in 1871. Well, suddenly this professor has just pointed out, and a judge has now taken up his essay on this, that 16 words of the original law somehow just disappeared. They just, wait a minute, it was in the law, and then when the law came down, these 16 words weren't in it. And those 16 words apply to any, you know, anybody within the jurisdiction of the United States that the deprivation of any rights, privileges, and immunities secured by the Constitution of the United States shall, and here are the 16 words, comma,
okay,
any such law, statute, ordinance, regulation, custom, or usage of the state to the contrary notwithstanding. In other words, they're saying that you have to read the article. It's very complicated, and this is why it you know, it happens, because it's so confusing. But the argument is, well, qualified immunity, the 1871 law didn't eliminate qualified immunity. Well, if you allow that parenthetical phrase that I just read, it does. You know what I mean? So somebody just took that parenthetical phrase out of the law, and it's not there. It's gone. You know what I mean? And so, you know, all of the legal rulings on qualified immunity are suggesting, well, qualified immunity still exists despite this 1871 law. Well, it exists because somebody on their own, corruptly, individually, secretly, took those 16 words out of the law. And I don't know. It's one of those stories that goes like, really? I mean, is this really what the law and the decisions of the legal are based on, this kind of stuff, that some arbitrarily excise of 16 words? Oops, I don't know where they went. And so, you know, a lot of these questions are coming into the fore because of the Supreme Court, because of other things, because of Trump's utter corrupt a stain for the law of any way. And so to me, you know, again, it's another indication that we're in a major reconstruction here, because, I mean, these are fundamental questions about the law. And we'll see, you know, where all these things come out, because the struggle is on. There's this backlash, and then there's the reconstruction, just like post-Civil War reconstruction and the Civil Rights Movement. And so this book I'm talking about by Thomas E. Ricks, published last year, called Waging a Good War, A Military History of the Civil Rights Movement from 1954 to 1968. And he's a war correspondent in Iraq and whatnot. He's written a number of books about Iraq and military operations and a couple of novels. And, you know, he decided, he just read about over 100 books on the civil rights movement, and he says, as a military historian, you've got to look at this movement as a war. You know, the civil rights movement as a war, the Reconstruction movement as a war itself, you know. And of course, with all the right-wing opposition to this Reconstruction effort at this point in history, I mean, they're loaded for bear, these people. You talk about a war, I mean, all the AR-15s and stuff they used to threaten everybody with. Well, you know, Thomas E. Ricks is saying, well, let's cut to the chase. Let's wake the fuck up and recognize that, you know, some people say it's a civil war coming, whatever it is. But if you look at the civil rights movement from, in his case, 54 to 68, you know, it follows strategy and tactics just like military operations, although it, you know, as in Martin Luther King, it uses nonviolence as a weapon, if you will, like from Gandhi's roots and stuff like that. And Gandhi was very strategic and very, you know, the idea of strategy versus tactics, which is the on-the-ground application of strategy. So it's a very, very interesting book for our time. And so I'm starting to read it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, my initial impression is that not about the book, but about the times we live in. I don't feel like we're in any position yet to come up with a strategy that people have nonviolence or otherwise stop this kind stop this kind of violence that's running. I mean, I've been sort of watching May 10th. It's in an article I've been working on, and it's, 199 mass shootings in 128 days.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. You just think of the numbers. It's mind-boggling. Yeah.
Right. And the mass shootings defined as four or more people injured in a single incident from a single shooter. So that's 100. And that was in May 10th. And since then, I just checked The Guardian out of England had they cited it, and I don't have I'll have it next time we talk, a database that statistic was cited 5 days ago.
Right.
Since that time,
well, there's virtually one every day or every other day now.
Since that time, it's now 123 134 days. So
right.
100. It's actually
amazing.
Growing. The rate per day is accelerating. It's still accelerating.
Idea of stochastic violence. I think, you know, I think that's pronounced right. The idea of, you know, sort of a random violence, and of course the talk about strategy here, you know, the strategy of encouraging and accepting stochastic violence, making no efforts whatsoever to prevent it, because it's the presence of weapons that allows it to happen. You know, if somebody had like a Bowie knife instead of a, you know, an AR-15, you know, we could take care of him. Everybody throw a fucking desk at him and we'll get him out of the way, you know. But it's the craziness of these weapons that with stochastic violence, with losers going out and shooting up schools for some lunatic, irrational reason, creates chaos and uncertainty, and nobody trusts anything anymore, and we're protecting ourselves, and even law-abiding citizens want to go out and get a gun to protect themselves, and, you know, the manufacturers love it because they make so much money out of this. They're making more designs. They're making, you know, more and more weapons. It's like absolute, utter fucking insanity, and yet that's how the country rolls these days, you know what I mean? And, lunacy.
That Guardian article, I'll look it up while we continue to visit here, but also pointed out that 3%, less than 3%, now this is a statistic grabbed over, I believe it was 6 years, the last 6 years, and they cited this database, an unbelievable number, of course, not unbelievable, I mean, they're all based on data collected. Less than 3% have stopped mass shootings with a civilian having a gun.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, so most of the mass shootings are done until law enforcement intervenes or interrupts the shooting going on.
And either forces the guy to commit suicide or kills him.
Surrender, kill, or suicide, Surrender, kill, or suicide.
And
that's 3% out of thousands of mass shootings have had over the last 6 years. I think it was this.
Well,
there
have also been a couple incidents. I remember one in North Carolina at one of those fast food stores, restaurants, where the guy who had solved the problem was gunned down himself when the cops got there.
That's what I'd be afraid of
if I happened to, for some reason, had a gun and was some reason brave enough and lucky enough to, you know, and then I turn around and I got 16 bullets in me from the cops who are panicking, you know.
Right. Well, that would be my fear.
Well,
I mean, I don't know if I'd be panicking, but I mean, the training of police nowadays is such that everybody's got a gun, and.
Yep.
If your job is to get home. That's literally that's a quote.
Right.
Your job is to get home. It's not to.
And you feel that you have qualified immunity, this magic term, because you are a cop. And in other words, your life is more valuable than somebody else, and you stand your ground in that idea. And because you're afraid, you're terrified, and you think this guy might have a gun. Like that guy, remember the guy in the car? He's in the passenger seat. His wife, girlfriend was driving, her baby in the back seat. An Asian cop comes up, and the guy has got his hands up, and he tells him, you know, because he wants to be straight. He says, I have a gun permit and I'm carrying a gun.
Yeah.
And then the guy shoots him.
Right.
You know, it's like, hello. And he got off. The guy got off, you know, because he was authentically scared. And he's a cop. You can get away with murder.
Yeah, I remember that. I can't remember the guy, the one that was the victim or the guy who was killed. But he reached into his glove compartment. That's how I think the cop got off.
Yeah, he was going to show him his carry permit or something.
Right.
And the guy just blew him away. And,
cop. Yeah.
Well, when you know when I did my,
when you have a gun pointed. Have you ever had have you ever had a gun pointed at you at close quarters? I mean, with the intent
of
shooting.
No, I don't think
you?
I have. No,
it's a very unnerving experience.
Well, I certainly believe it would be. So you've had that experience.
Yeah, I was in Missouri and as a private detective and I was not supposed to be in this neighborhood. I was doing some surveillance work, and I made the mistake of having a police scanner, a portable police scanner, laying on the front seat of my car that I was sitting in, listening to the police traffic, and it's a major felony in Missouri to do that. And I did not know that, and this cop come up and just stuck a gun at me through my car window. Wow. You know, he's totally almost shit my pants. You know, I was like, wait a minute, you know.
Oh, given that, the only thing, I was actually threatened by one of our local White Marsh police here when a gravel incident where I stopped a guy from dumping gravel in our joint driveway with my neighbors, and he threatened me. So I said, come on out of the fucking cab, you cowardly cocksucker. You want to fight? Let's do it. You know, and he couldn't believe that this mild-mannered suburban guy was, you know, I'd had it up to here, you know what I mean? And so he then called the police, locked his doors and called the police. And they came out, and at the end of it all, one of the cops said, if you'd done to me what you did to him, I would have shot you. You're kidding me, you jerk. And so then I told him, well, you can leave my back porch. Thank you very much. You know, so I never had the gun in my face. Yeah, I can see how that would be quite startling. Yeah,
several times. One time, I was serving a subpoena on a divorce guy. He didn't know he was going to get a divorce, and I was serving a summons. It wasn't a subpoena, so a summons. And I just knocked on the door to give him the paperwork. You know, to let him know process.
Sure.
Here,
yeah, of course,
you know, you have to go to court. He just opened the door and stuck a gun in my forehead.
Wow.
He didn't even know who I was. He just saw me in my detective suit, tie, and a piece of paper in my hand. My weapon was concealed. He had no idea that I had one. And he just stuck a gun in my face when he opened the door.
So at that point, you said, well, oh, excuse me, sir, I must be at the wrong house.
No, actually, I just said, here, you've been served, and I dropped the paper in front of him.
Oh, good.
And
okay, well, that's good. You did your job. You did your job.
Well, but it's unnerving. It is unnerving.
I hear you.
Is this worth $50? Because that's all I was getting paid for doing
right.
that.
Right. Dead is dead, you know?
And at that time, I just had a new, 1 year, you know, 6 months, like I was one year old baby at home, you know, so.
There you go.
But that's why I'm saying cops are trained that way, to just assume that the person you had that. So I find it's not good, it's not fair, and it's unreasonable. And I think this thing about your thing about qualified immunity, I'm not sure how that applies to the debt ceiling limit, but I think it has.
Well, yeah, I guess maybe I did make a leap there, but I guess the point was when I was saying that, you know, I read a story where Biden had non-legislative options, you know, that were unprecedented legally, but, you know, creative use of the law. You know, we had a lot of this creative sophist use of the law these days because nobody trusts it anymore. And so you get a lot of corrupt manipulations of the law. So the liberals and Biden would be saying, well, listen, God damn it, this is a desperate situation. So, yeah, we're going to try an unprecedented rule, whatever, I forgot where it was,
I think it goes to the
14th Amendment.
The 14th
exactly.
Amendment, yeah.
Right. In other words, the United States, by constitutional amendment, must answer and address its debts, period, apparently.
Right.
In some way it says that, maybe in some parenthetical phrase like the one they eliminated here in 1611. But they didn't eliminate that. And, you know, so in other words, use that. It's never been used in this context. And, of course, therefore, it would have to go up the chain of command in the justice system and to the Supreme Court. And those five goddamn conservative justices would have to respond to it. Okay.
Right.
So, it's, you know, on Clarence Thomas's robed shoulders to decide now, not the president, whether the United States will go in default and the dollar will fall and the debt bomb will, you know, all that complicated crap that may follow, not in a rational manner, but when the world responds to things, it often responds irrationally. So, you know, again, they're pushing the law at the edges, unprecedented in experimental ways, which, you know, Trump and those do all the time, and saying, look, we're desperate. We got to do this. And so now you guys in the Supreme Court, if you want to throw the United States of America in an unprecedented historical, you know, area where it doesn't pay its debt, it's up to you, fat fucks, to do that. Go ahead. You know, and I think that's where it may go, you know, because McCarthy, you know, may be fine with the chaos. They think, you know, because we have the guns, we have the lust for power, pure lust for power on the right. So you bring on the chaos. We'll control it with our cruelty, with our muscle, with our power, you know.
And, you know, crazy shoes.
Donald Trump just did this outrageous thing on CNN, and he's resurrecting, you know, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, my favorite fascist in all America.
No kidding. He's
you know, he's got this Reawaken America program going. You know, Michael Flynn is a very dangerous man. And, of course, Ron DeSantis worked under him in Iraq, you know, when he was the advisor for SEAL Team 1.
I did not know that. I know that his brother, Charles Flynn, is just as crazy as his brother. And after January 6th, mysteriously, and I've never been able to get a reporter to look at this or look at it or find a way to figure out. Mysteriously, Charles was at the Pentagon on January 6th and immediately was transferred out of the Pentagon to the beautiful land of Hawaii. That's where he's at, is in Hawaii right now. And I'm like thinking, now that's a really slick move. I mean, move this guy who probably was a main line of communication with his brother about whether they were going to deploy troops, armed troops, to defend the Capitol building that day. I strongly suspect that. I really do.
My thing with Michael Flynn was under the Stanley McChrystal, four-star General Stanley McChrystal, who was gave the rule of the, quote, so-called surge in Anbar province. And, of course, McChrystal went in there and, you know, smacked around the intelligence and the, you know, they would – The intelligence was a goddamn mess before he came in with, you know, with all those angry guerrillas in Anbar that turned into ISIS eventually. And, you know, that McChrystal had Michael Flynn was McChrystal's intelligence general. He was in charge of intelligence in Anbar province in the surge. So technically, you know, DeSantis as the JAG officer was under McChrystal, of course, as the ultimate ruler. But, you know, the three-star general is an intel director. You know, when intelligence was the point of the surge, they would go out at a raid at 7 o'clock at night, kick in doors, harass people, and arrest them, bring them to Abu Ghraib or whatever they did, and then they would bring their cell phones and their computers, they'd bring them back, and they had a crack team that would go through these computers, and, you know, within a half an hour, they'd get a list of other names and addresses, and they'd send out other intel units to crack down their doors and harass them and, you know, run the children into a room and scare them to death and arrest their father and all this kind of shit. And then he would take their laptops and they'd go through them. So that by the morning, they'd made six raids. you know, more, yeah. You know, they're gathering, and by the next night they do six more. And so they really effectively cleaned out the insurgents in Anbar province. Well, they cleaned them out so effectively, they became psychopathic head chopper offers, you know, and they just went nuts with ISIS. And that's what happened. And it got, you know, it escalated, it got worse. And, you know, finally, you know, they did clean out ISIS, I guess. But, you know, my theory is that, unfortunately, Michael Flynn, you know, is off the reservation and has learned some pretty horrific ways of gathering intelligence and intimidating people and even killing people. And now the taboo has been broken. There's always been a taboo, you know, with the Guatemala 54. They bamboozled people in Guatemala with all this mind fucking and stuff in 54 and other things throughout our history. You know, they only learned it more and more, but there was always a taboo that you can't use this kind of militarist violation and a manipulation of people in the domestic United States where we have elections and all that. Well, that prohibition, I think, is effectively lifted. And now it's anything goes with the internet, with the iPhones and AI and all the AI, you know, how you Trump and these gangs are going to be using AI. Oh, it's disgusting.
Well, and then they have popularized these patches on their unregulated militias, patch on it, RWDS, Right Wing Death Squad. It's not just a few of these low IQ idiots that showed up at the January 6th riot. These things go, these patches travel all. That if that's the mentality, and this is something I think you missed, but you're right about 1954 in Guatemala. Right. But you're very much more familiar than on the show, on our show here. Talking about the activity of the use of right-wing death squads in Central America.
Of course, you know, the same way Thomas E. Ricks uses all his war correspondent experience and is writing books about militarism and all that, the way he uses it now as a template to discuss the civil rights movement. Well, I understand that implicitly, totally, because the way I see the rise of Trump and Michael Flynn and fascism, and you're talking about right-wing death squads, it's sort of, you know, if it really goes south, that's inevitable where it is with all the guns and the Proud Boys, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you know, I was in and out of El Salvador in the midst of all that stuff and death squads, and, you know, I've had dinner with Medardo Gomez after he was captured by a death squad and intimidated. You know, I photographed Aya Curia, the Jesuit who was shot in the back of the head with his other five companions. All of that stuff, you know, I can see it happening here. I can see it happening here. The same way Thomas Ricks is saying it's a war, you know, because... you know, the civil rights movement was defending itself against a really militarized KKK-sponsored, et cetera, use of violence to intimidate and to keep black people in their place, if you will. Well, you know, as he argues, you know, they were using strategy and tactics of war, albeit nonviolence was their weapon. But the key was that they put their lives on the line, and some of them lost their lives, and some of them were maimed and injured and all that, like in wars. And so his point is, you know, call it war, whatever you want. You know, William James raised the idea of war as a metaphor, war on the poverty and that sort of thing. You know, the pragmatist philosopher William James, you know, so okay, maybe there's a metaphoric aspect in here, but, you know, when you think about it as strategy and here, let me read you the first paragraph. It's really brilliant, this guy's, what he's done, it's, I think. Yeah, of course, he's a white guy, too, you know, he's a historian. In the 1960s, the United States became a genuine democracy for the first time in its history, as laws and practices that prevented many black Americans from voting were challenged by the civil rights movement. By the end of the decade, almost all adult citizens finally were able to vote. This may sound mundane, but the vote is the fundamental building block of our nation. It is our primary means of bringing about political change nonviolently. It determines policy and actions, where money is spent, which roads are paved, how schools are run, and whether police act as antagonists or protectors. Now, six decades later, a significant part of the American political establishment has succeeded in repealing many of the voting gains of the 1960s. This national arc led me to go back and read hundreds of books on the civil rights movement. The more I delved into that history, the more I found myself calling on my own experience as a war correspondent to interpret what I was reading. I saw the overall strategic thinking that went into the movement, with a capital M, and the field tactics that flowed from that strategy. Problems I was familiar with from covering military operations in Somalia, Bosnia, Afghanistan, and Iraq, and from writing books about World War II and the conflicts of Korea and Vietnam were all addressed in careful, systematic ways by those in the civil rights movement. Recruiting, training, planning, logistics, communications, and more. I began to see the movement as a kind of war. That is a series of campaigns on carefully chosen ground that eventually led to victory. The Siege of Montgomery, the Battle of Birmingham, the March on Washington, the frontal assault on Selma. There were other, anyway, he goes on, and on, you know, it's like pretty serious thesis he's got going here, you know?
Yeah, I'm going to be interested in hearing your analysis about the book, as you read it. I mean, this morning, you were... repeat the name and the author of the book again.
Name of the book is 2022, published, Waging a Good War, A Military History of the Civil Rights Movement, 1954 to 1968, by Thomas E. Ricks, R-I-C-K-S.
Okay. I want to hear more about it because we're going to definitely, I got a bad feeling that we're going to definitely need to have some strategy because and tactics.
Right.
That's really what it tells me. I saw that news story about the proliferation of these patches that are on these militia, how they're growing. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's like their badge of honor. That's the initials for Right Wing Death Squad. And I thought some of these people that were arrested in the Proud Boys had them on them on January 6th. And I do think people, and I have a lot of respect for Max Blumenthal. I really do. Mm-hmm. I got his books. I read his books. I watch The Gray Zone. But he described January 6th. He described the activity on January 6th as a low IQ riot. That's a quote, low IQ riot, unquote. And I think many people are looking, and maybe one way of diffusing the right is by uniting with parts of the right. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but I'm not saying that's what he's doing, but
right,
I'm saying
right,
that
right.
I think there's a lot of people in the quote unquote left who underestimate the lethality of the right wing, and that's based on my.
I think you're right. The potential lethality. I mean, as somebody has said, well, if you want to understand somebody, just listen to what they say. Well,
right.
You know, these guys, you know, using their presence of guns and their lust for guns and all that, you know. Joy Reid yesterday made an interesting question. She's an MSNBC black woman. And, you know, talking about this basketball player, this dumb shit basketball player who keeps, he can't avoid it on his Facebook waving about pistols and stuff, right? Well, he was in trouble with it. He just did it again, right? And, you know, he's a, you know, black dude with dreads and things, and he's waving a pistol in a car. And think, oh my God, this is horrible. This is dreadful. This is criminal. This is, you know, we must nail this son of a bitch, right? Well, yeah, I mean, that resonates with me. I think he's irresponsible. I think he's a jerk. Well, Joy Reid says, okay, fair enough. But what about, you know, this Boebert, this congresswoman in Colorado, and another male congressman from somewhere else, both of them had Christmas cards or whatever the hell they were with their children brandishing literally, you know, real, AK, you know, AR-15.
Assault rifles.
Now, what's the difference between this suburban, wonderful family showing guns, you know, waving around like a fetish, and this, you know, dumb shit basketball player? What difference is it between A and B, except, you know, the basketball player is black, you know, and these people are very institutionalized and white, you know?
No. I think you missed something there.
Well, tell me what I missed. No, I want to hear it.
Well, both of those campaign photographs that were circulated by both of those candidates were in front of Christmas trees, and
right,
implying a white Christian religion I'm just saying that's the difference.
Yeah, but hypocrisy's hypocrisy, you know. Whether you love Christmas and Christ or whether you love basketball, I don't know what the hell difference it make. Now,
well,
if you're a crazy Christian, I guess it makes a big difference, you know.
Well, yeah, it's their right. They believe it's their, that they think they actually get off on this. They enjoy this. This is their culture, and it's as much
right.
As
but
it is
in
a,
my argument,
a,
if you believe Thomas E. Ricks, if you believe Thomas E. Ricks, that we're going into, you know. If you look at the civil rights movement, it was a war, and we're going into again. So, yeah, okay. So one side can provoke by all these AR-15s and saying, well, Jesus told me that it was okay. And of course, some black dude who knows he's the brunt of this, he's the one that they're pointing at, he's silly enough to wave around a 9mm. Well, of course, you know, he's I suppose, in a defensive position. You know, it's like the Palestinians. It's another issue. You know, the Palestinians have just, you know, the UN just had to commemorate the displacement of Palestinians. They had this big thing yesterday and in which it was well attended. And, you know, Mohammed Abbas, the president of the Palestinians, took the floor. And, you know, it was about a despicable events, the Nabka, you know, where they in 47 and 48, you know, where the Israelis, you know, pushed around the Palestinians and took their homes, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And, you know, made, you know, so we get the argument now, essentially from Netanyahu and company and Israelis, is that historically Palestinians are losers. If you simply accept that you're a goddamn loser, everything will be fine. And the Palestinians say, no, we are not accepting that we're losers. And of course, black people here are somewhat, you know, analogously in the same situation. Look, just realize you're a loser and we'll take care of you, you know. I mean, we got more
but
guns.
Don't go waving
about guns. That really upsets us, you know. And,
we don't. You're proving
you know what I mean?
Gangster.
It's
you're
I don't know. Just the
us.
Hypocrisy. See, nobody gives a damn about hypocrisy anymore. We're in such a corrupt world. Like, hypocrisy, get away. It's like you farted in church. That's okay now. You know, it's okay. I'm sorry. I'm on a bad
tear
here.
No, that's okay. That's why we get you on here.
That's the trouble with your show. I just can somehow go off a little sometimes.
Well, I made you. I have to admit, I throw pepper in the in your face.
You did. You stirred me up, Mike.
I mean, these candidates like Lauren Boebert and MTG,
right.
Marjorie Taylor Greene,
right,
running around with their guns and posing in front of Christmas trees. And, you know, I think to me, it's, you know, and then compare that to a, I don't know, this black young man waving a gun from his car, gangster
right.
type, you know. I mean, to me, it's sort of like the ugly end of the same stick. And I sort of think the but these people.
What? Say that again.
The ugly end of the same stick.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like,
all
right. Yeah, it's like both ends of the stick are nasty. You know, it's sort of like
right. Yeah, like
gangsters on one. And,
right.
I think, but they have the, what they believe, and they have succeeded in
mm-hmm.
convincing huge swaths of quote unquote self-styled Christianity and
mm-hmm.
Donald Trump even, okay, and many parts of the wealthy people that they have moral superiority and they have the agency to impose a white Christian fascist type order on the gangsters and the black youth and the
of course
the,
well I mean that's why they like Donald Trump so much. He's, you know, they know he's a terrible Christian. They know damn well he's, you know, an immoral, you know, Christian. He, you know, has sex with whores and God knows what, you know. And they don't seem to care because he's the
right.
instrument of their ascendancy, you know. It's like God sent him, you know, and it's like you go, really? Really? Is that what you're really telling us, Barry?
Has DeSantis, in your opinion, thrown a curveball for the Donald Trump campaign? I mean, they're both in Florida. But, I mean, you know, I mean,
well,
you think that,
yeah.
You
know,
my
analogy for DeSantis is that here's a guy who made his spurs as a
right.
JAG officer overseeing the force feeding torture. It was declared torture, force feeding
right.
of fasting people in Guantanamo. And there's a piece in Baffler magazine and on. You know, what he did, how he assured them, I have your interests at heart, I'm going to protect you, and then he'd be off giggling when they're force-feeding them and all this.
Right.
And one of the guys said he puked on him. He puked all over DeSantis, you know. And so here you got DeSantis who, you know, is supporting, legally supporting torture, telling them, well, this, you can't do this, I'm not telling you what to do, but you know don't do this, and this is acceptable,
yeah.
or don't tell me about it, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, right.
So here's a guy that figured out he was good at being cruel, you know, as the book guy wrote the book called Cruelty is the Point.
He's good at spawning cruelty among his fellow soldiers.
Right, and so basically he's using those muscles as the governor, you know, doing these radical things like abortion.
Yeah,
because
there are
all
people. Right, I mean, I saw all these women, young girls
yeah.
and men, women
yeah.
lined up behind him when he signed one of the most draconian abortion bills in the country.
Right, but so my point is that I've always said this, and I still believe it, that America, being America and history, when things get kind of extreme, Americans get worried, and then the voting, it's sort of like gravity hews to the center. So there's like a ditch or a groove, and, you know, when the shit really hits the fan extreme, you know, America is a centrist nation, you know. So I think that's going to come out and play. That I don't think Ron DeSantis is going to be nominated, because Ron DeSantis, I think, is going to overextend himself in his glee of finding out how tough he is and his ability to get these cruel things on the record, that eventually it's going to come back and bite him in the ass, and he's going to end up overextended like the coyote in the Roadrunner cartoons. You know, the coyote, you know that famous
right.
scene where the coyote's about 10 feet, he's 10 feet over the edge of the cliff, and suddenly he realizes it, and he looks at you, his eyes get big, and he looks down, and he looks at you, and he says, oh, shit. And at that point, he falls like a rock, and there's a little poof at the bottom of the cliff down below in the canyon.
Yes.
Well, you've heard it here first. That's going to be the future of Ron DeSantis. He's going to overextend and end up like the coyote. So we'll see.
Yeah, we will.
Of course, I love the Roadrunner cartoons. I always loved them.
Yeah, well, I did too when I was
beep beep.
It helped me get through adolescence. It helped me enter adolescence. I became an adolescent watching them.
Well, the other one I liked is Daffy Duck. I just always loved Daffy Duck. You know, Flipper, Duck Attack.
He stumbled in and out of the many adventures and crises. You know, I mean, he was always somebody wanting to kill him. You know,
and he's so frustrated all the time.
He always come out of it okay, but it's like you don't know how he did that. So maybe that should be the strategy of the opposition in America to violent, crazy, violent.
The
crazy
Daffy
people.
Duck approach, yeah, okay.
The Daffy Duck strategy. You know, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. That's probably more like the Abby Hoffman strategy, actually, if you ask me.
Right.
I'm not sure how we're going to get through it, frankly, because I do see it.
Well, we're going to get through it one way or another, or else we aren't. You know, one or the other.
I know. That's right. I saw this. I'm going to say it. I saw this developing 30 years ago in 1990.
Yeah. Well,
Before Timothy McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma City federal building, they were out there.
I think all of this stuff, I mean, this has been existent in American history. There's nothing new here. Well, the only thing new is that it's going mainstream in a way it never has.
Right. It wasn't mainstream at that time. At the time, it was just these guys with guns in the back windows of their pickups driving by the abortion clinics I was assigned to protect. And I knew that they were in militias because I would track them down. But, I mean, they didn't come up. They didn't feel strong enough to bring their guns up to the picket line, even the picket, to stand outside and taunt me with their guns. They didn't do that. They did not do that in 1990, 1991. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But when these crazy bastards that I was tracking, taking down their license plate numbers, figuring out who they were, you know, when they less than 100 miles south of me from Wichita, Kansas at that time, they blew up the Oklahoma City federal building, I began to realize this is going to get serious shit. We got to get out of this business.
Well, unlike a lot of people, you've been in it. You've been in it. You know, you were.
I've been trying, and I've written it. I've warned about the theocrats. I used to call them theocrats in the state government who tolerates these kind of people, you know. They haven't went away. They have many, 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 many supporters in the Republican Party of Kansas, and many, many, many people who in the state house who support them. And I've written and warned people in myriad of ways. And now it's taken over. And what my horror!
Well,
it's taken over.
You know,
the whole country,
we have this idea
the
of the
fucking country.
This whole idea of the Reconstruction. We have to keep at it. You know, we got to keep be truth tellers, and we got to and not give up and recruit other truth tellers in this waging a good war idea of Thomas E. Ricks.
Well,
I
expect a full book report next week on Tuesday.
Well, it's like
John
a 600. It's a how many? It's like a 400 page book. So
you can do it.
I don't read big books these days. I read a lot of pieces in a lot of little books. You know, I read like 10 books, little pieces in 10 books rather than one book all the way through.
I
want to read a lot of this book, so I'm going to do that. Next
All
week.
All right,
I'll
hope you do. All right,
okay.
Tell us more about it.
John Grant. I will. All right, Mike. Good talking with you.